Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, episode 70, Back in the North. So before I get this episode started, I would like to just tell everyone what's changed. The audio quality with my computer is acting weird, so if I sound a little funny, I'm sorry. But it's been giving me like this a lot of problems, and I can't figure out why. So that was part of my issues early on, was that I was trying to record episodes, but they just were sounding terrible. But the next most important change is that my wedding has happened. Yes, me and now Mrs. American Revolution Podcast have tied the knot. We got married at Valley Forge National Historical Park, where we were married in the Washington Memorial Chapel, and we had our reception on the grounds at the Knox Estate, not to be confused with Henry Knox, which is a historic home on the grounds. So a lot of things happened. When you get married, the couple weeks before the wedding, if you have a life, just forget that it ever existed the month before a wedding, because it's not existent. And then when you have the wedding, I don't remember a single thing that happened that day. I honestly, the day went so fast, I can't remember a thing. I remember flashes, bits and pieces of things that went on. And I just... Well, I'm happy it's done and over with. The party was fantastic. The wedding, from what I can remember, was gorgeous. Like I said, bits and pieces, flashes. It goes by so quickly, you don't even have a second to take it in. The most important thing was that the families got together, had a great time, fantastic time, and I wanted the hotel that we had. Like, they were the nicest people in the world. And they really were super kind, considering that with our two families, we like to sit up late at night and talk and party. So considering that both nights we were up until like 3-4 in the morning, the Friday and the day after the wedding, that Saturday, up until 3-4 in the morning both nights, I mean, really got to give Homewood Suites credit for, you know, really putting up with us. But it is now May. Everything is now back to some semblance of normalcy. And I want to get us back to the war in the North. Yes, not to be confused with what Jon Snow just did on the most recent episode of Game of Thrones, but the war in the North of the American Revolution is probably one of the most pivotal campaigns in the entire American Revolution. In the background, you are hearing my beagle, who is being very vocal right now, and I don't know why. Go lay down, little man. He wants to be part of the podcast, too. He's a great dog, but he just likes to chitter-chatter. Anyway, back to what we were saying. Apparently, I'm deciding to do this podcast live, where I'm getting all of the, you know, stuff I would normally cut out. But he is a super needy puppy right now, so he is whimpering in my ear. What can I say? So, the war in the North. When last we left off about a month and a half ago, we were talking about Washington and the Forage War. He was trying to settle into winter quarters. He wanted to make sure that he had enough supplies to get his men through the winter. And in that time, we spent a lot of time with Washington's army talking about movements, preparations, battles. But what about what's going on in the North? The Army of the Northern Department lost the Battle of Valcour Island. They squared off with the British on Lake Champlain in the summer of 1776. There was a lot of hard work to build a navy that would stand up to the British Navy on the lake. The British come to the table with several large vessels, including the Inflexible, which was similar to an ocean-worthy schooner. It was even a small frigate. It was a very large ship, and they spent a lot of time building it. They also had the Thunderer. The Thunderer. To this day, I still can't wrap my head around how they named that ship. But anyway, it was basically a floating battery. Once again, another ship that really didn't play a pivotal role in the battle. They had the Maria and the Carlton, two schooners that didn't play a pivotal role in the battle. What really played a pivotal role was the British Navy, or the British Army, building small gunboats, single cannons put on the bow. They could be rowed, they could be sailed, but the whole purpose of these ships was to get in close and lay into the American fleet. They had 22 of them. And of those 22 ships, most of them sported something on along the lines of a 9 or a 12, and in some cases, there was a couple that had 24-pounders. Something, I think, a little too expansive for a small gunboat, but hey, what am I to say? They were in charge. These 22 vessels bring the fire when it comes to Arnold's Navy. Arnold had gondolas. They were masted but rowable ships that sported anywhere from 6 to 9-pound guns. Good pieces for the field, not great on naval warfare. One, they don't have a great long range, and they don't have a lot of stopping power when it comes to hitting a strong vessel. So if they were going to go up against the Inflexible, they were going to fall short. Inflexible was a big ship. Against the gunboats, they would be very useful. Problem was that gunboats outgunned them. And so Arnold now has these ships where he has to fire from a broadside or almost an angled shot, where he's opening up a large profile of the ships. And the ships for about half a day are getting hammered. I mean, they're returning fire in good order, but they're getting hammered. The gunboats are out of range. They're doing the best they can. None of the gunboats are destroyed. One of the American schooners is destroyed. When they lose that ship, it just became a really big mess. The gondolas and their square-masted gondolas, row galleys, excuse me, their row galleys just are ineffective. So what does Arnold do? Well, he says, at the end of it, I'm just going to run for it. I'm going to run for it. And that's what he does. He runs the gauntlet. He heads down south. When the British figure out the next day that Arnold's making a run for it, they give chase. Now, when they were having the battle itself, the British were kept back by a north wind that was blowing south and keeping the ships from moving in close to finish off Arnold. Arnold uses that wind to his advantage to make his getaway because the wind shifted in the night. But then in the daytime, it shifts again, and it's blowing in his face. So his men are under row power. But his ships are so beat up, his men are so exhausted, they can't keep up. So Arnold is now making a run for it against the odds. They are making their way back to Fort Ticonderoga. If they can get to Ticonderoga, then the British Navy will back off. They'll have protection from the fort. They have men there. They have some extra ships and some supplies. They'll be able to make a stand. But they don't get there. They barely make – some of the ships don't even make it to Crown Point. The Americans either scuttle the ships and abandon and run for the woods and make their way back to Fort Ticonderoga, or they're captured. And so these ships Arnold's Navy is pretty much wiped off the face of the map in October 1776. They're not going to be a force to be reckoned with on Lake Champlain. All that stands between the British and Albany is Fort Ticonderoga. But here's the thing. Fort Ticonderoga is a fairly large defensive position. The British know it well. They had a fight there several times during the French and Indian War. But the key thing that they need to remember is it's October of 1776. And in just a few short weeks, even a month, it's going to get bitterly cold. It's going to start to frost tonight, and eventually it's going to snow, and snow a lot. And when it snows, the lake freezes. And when the lake freezes, you have no way to move troops on the water. Your supply lines are cut because the lake is frozen. So this is what is the real victory for Arnold, is he took his men, he put them to work to build a navy, and they came out in a lot of people's opinions, aces. Okay, some people will say, well, you know, they should have waited, they should have did this, they should have did that. But if you look at what happened to Arnold, he's hampered by smallpox. They don't have enough supplies. They don't have enough men. And then when they get the ships ready, they don't have Navy men. They have soldiers. A lot of these men have never been on a boat before. And then you're sending them north to fight a British Navy. They're well-trained. These men are experienced. So you're looking – you have to look at it as a glass half-full type thing. Yes, the Navy is defeated. But what have you gained? Time. Carleton wasted tons and tons of time building this Navy that he was going to sail south to defeat Arnold and his Navy. Arnold and Gates spent the summer months preparing the fort, building a Navy, getting these men ready because they knew that they had to stall the British. And so Arnold heads north in the end of September. And he's looking for the British. He's waiting for the British. Eventually the British show up. It's October by this point, folks. And soon winter is coming. Okay? And when winter comes, the British cannot lay siege to Ticonderoga. They would have no way to get supplies. They would be out in the open in the winter in northern New York. Not a prospect that worked out so very well for the Americans not 1 year earlier. If you remember back to Quebec, Arnold sat there in the snow, trenches, cannons with ice as blockers, as they stood outside of Quebec and just stared at the old city walls. Well, was Carleton going to do the same thing? No, he has to recall his army. It's a huge success for the British, for the Americans, because they now have gained themselves time. And that's something that the British, well, they have no interest in taking more time in this war. There was one man that was definitely not a fan of it, and this is where we're really going to start our story. This episode was going to be a big review of everything that we talked about in the North. But now we're going to start to take a first look at one of our key players. That's John Burgoyne. After Valcour Island, he's of the mind, let's press our advantage. We've got them on the ropes. Their navy is shattered. Their men are beat up. There isn't a large body of troops protecting Fort Ticonderoga. Bring the fleet down. Let's see what we can do. Well, the problem is, Carleton didn't want to do that. Too far away from supply lines. What happens when winter comes? A lot of questions were asked in that time period. And the whole time Burgoyne is saying we should press our advantage. When Carleton decides against it, Burgoyne presses his own advantage. He decides that he's going to return to England and spend the winter there. Smart. Who wants to spend the winter in Canada? No offense to Canadians, but it's very cold, and a lot of white is happening up there, like just snow all the time. All right? Now, personally, coming from the state of Maine, I get what the Canadians see, because that was a lot of snow. That was a lot of snow. But I just know the history and the summer, the winters of during the American Revolution. They were in the middle of what was known as the mini ice age, where the winters were god awfully cold, and record percentages of precipitation fell. Ungodly amounts of snow was on the ground in these winters, and well, I just wouldn't want to be in Canada during one of those winters. But Burgoyne isn't afraid of the winter. No. Burgoyne is going to press his own advantage when he goes back to England. This is the second time that Burgoyne served in a subordinate capacity. The first was in 1775 when he arrived in Boston with Howe and Clinton to take over for Gage. Howe becomes the overall commander. Burgoyne is subordinate. In the summer of 1776, he's up in Canada, where he again is serving as subordinate to Carleton. And so he decides that he's going to return to England and do a little self-promoting. He's going to find a way to get himself put in front of a standing army as the overall commander, and he's going to do something in his mind excellent, something incredible that is going to turn the hearts and the minds of the British people, and he will, you know, get the recognition that he deserves. When he gets back, he finds out that Carleton has taken credit as the heroic commander of Valcour Island. But there's an opening. Parliament and the king are not impressed with Carleton. Yes, he won a naval victory. Surprise, surprise, the British have been winning at navy stuff for a long time. But they needed more. Why didn't he take Ticonderoga? He had the opportunity. And that was the opportunity the Major General was looking for. This self-promotion. He met with Germain, who was basically the eyes and ears of the king and all things that had to go along with the American Revolution. And he discusses with Germain and the king a spring campaign. Now, the thing is, most of his information is guesswork. Okay? It's based off the idea that there was an army of about 12,000 men at Fort Ty. He would take a force of 8,000 regulars, 2,000 Canadians, 1,000 loyal Indians. Of this 11,000, 3,000 would be left behind to hold the Canadian territory. With this 8,000-man army, he would head south. The plan was to set up a battery at Crown Point. From there, they would head to Fort Ty, take the fort, and then head down to Albany. From there, he would establish contact with General Howe in New York City. Burgoyne suggested a secondary force move from Lake Ontario towards Oswego along the Mohawk River, which meets the Hudson, which will meet the Hudson not too far from Albany, not too far north from Albany. Now, the king and Germain love the plan. Germain issued the following orders in a letter to Carleton. Carleton was to remain in Canada and guard the province with 3,770 men. I don't know why they chose such a specific number, but okay. Of specified British and German regiments. And to detach Burgoyne with their remaining 7,173 British and German regiments. Burgoyne will also outfit Colonel Barry St. Ledger with 675 men and with a sufficient number of Canadians and Indians for this Mohawk Valley campaign. This was going to be the definitive blow in Burgoyne's head. We can cut the head from the snake right here. I go to Albany. Howe meets me in Albany. Guess what? I control everything north of Albany to Canada. He controls everything south of Albany to New York City. There is no way an American force could pass to New England without us knowing about it. So one of the biggest suppliers of troops for the Continental Army will be cut off from getting to Washington, who is in the south. On paper, this is a brilliant plan. So everyone is behind it. The king is behind it. Germain's behind it. So even right Carleton. The letter made Carleton extremely angry. That's kind of how Germain planned it. Germain even went so far to blame Carleton for Trenton. He blamed him for Trenton. Now, here's the thing. I am not a Guy Carleton fan, by any stretch of the imagination, but somehow he blamed him for Trenton. Blamed him for Trenton. If you didn't notice, they're not very close together at all. Sorry, I'm just in awe of that. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't respect a lot of British commanders. I do respect Howe, and I do respect Cornwallis. I think they're very good field commanders. And Cornwallis was a bit extreme, but Howe had the right idea on how to run a war when it came to dealing with a colony. But at the end of the day, I feel like blaming a guy for a battle that took place 500 miles from where he was stationed, bit of a stretch, just saying. Anyway, my rant aside. Burgoyne will arrive in Quebec on May 6th, 1777. His troops were in good shape. Their uniforms, not so much. But of the problems that Burgoyne had, their uniform condition was probably his biggest concern. When it came to his irregular troops, though, that was a problem. You know, see, the regulars were great. He had enough troops to protect the city, along with set up St. Ledger and form his campaign. He had 3,724 British troops. Once again, don't ask me how they get such specific numbers. And then 3,016 German troops. The irregular troops of his 2,000 Canadians and Tories, he had 150 Canadians and 100 Tories. Not the numbers he was looking for. And of his 1,000 Indians, he got 400. I mean, better than the situation with the Canadians and the Tories, but still not a fantastic situation for Burgoyne to be getting into. The artillery train was very extensive. They had everything from 3 to 24-pound cannons and mortars. Mortars make sense to me, but why 24-pound guns? Like, why are you firing from a mile away? It didn't, like, we'll see how those come into play later. Even the 12-pounders, they're not field pieces, so I don't understand what he was going for. I know that the 12-pounders are good siege guns. Just the 24-pounders just seemed like a waste of time and energy. But that's just me. The commander of the German troops was the Baron von Riedesel. He was probably one of the best German field commanders that we will run into during the American Revolution. He was definitely a man that was respected among the Germans and the British alike. As for Burgoyne's second-in-command, it was Simon Fraser, another excellent field commander. And we're going to talk about both of these men as we continue on with the campaign, but that really sets the stage for everything that's going to be coming to us in the coming weeks. We have two armies. One's a bit in tatters, the other one is ready and raring to go. Burgoyne is at the head of it. He's been known to be aggressive. He's been known to be a bit overzealous in certain areas. But he has Simon Fraser, who's one of the best field commanders the British have in this particular theater. And he has the Baron von Riedesel, who's one of the best field commanders of the German troops that were in the American Revolution, if not the best. So he's got good field commanders around him. So hopefully for the British, that's, you know, a hopeful offsetting. His zealousness with their ability in the field would be a perfect fit. So we're going to see how it plays out. There's lots of battles ahead of us, lots of time to spend looking at these characters. This is not going to be a short campaign for us by any stretch of the imagination. This episode was rather long for the fact that I wanted to really set the stage, remind everyone, where were we with the North? Where are we going with the North? And who are some of our key cast of characters? And next week, I'm going to look at the American side of things, and we're going to start looking at, real closely, the siege of Fort Ticonderoga. The school year is ending for me. We're getting close to that time. I'm hopefully going to be on a once-a-week episode schedule, so be prepared for those. Thank you, everyone, for your patience. I know that 6 weeks was a bit longer than I had said an episode would come out. But like I said, the wedding was a big deal on my calendar. Now that it's passed, my schedule starts to open up for things that I would like to get done. And this podcast, continuing this podcast, is definitely a priority for me in the coming weeks. So till next week, everyone remember, have a great week and keep that powder dry. Mm-hmm.